Welcome to the Web Directions North podcast series. These presentations were recorded in Vancouver, February 7th and 8th, 2007. For more materials from this conference series, please visit webdirections.org. This podcast is licensed by Web Directions and the speaker under Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 2.5 license. Please include this audio license notice with any copy or derivative work of the podcast that you distribute.
Hello. Testing. Oh, there we go. I'll bet you guys can hear me now. Slowly. So, I'm going to be very, very brief here, because not only am I standing, well, I was going to say standing between, but I guess standing next to one of the foremost web accessibility advocates and experts, but I'm also standing between you and free booze. I really recommend that right after the session you go over and take advantage of the bounty that we'll be serving over there with Adobe's compliments. I've been told that we're going to be having a fireside chat here, so I'm looking forward to that personally. I work on the Dreamweaver team, and we deal with kind of the difficulty of developing accessible sites on a regular basis. I mean, we really know that pain, and I think that Joe is one of the people that really has some of the answers to those problems and can really help us get better at developing accessible sites and making accessibility more part of the web design and development process. So without further ado, Joe Clark.
Thank you. It's great to be here at Web Directions. Last time I was in Vancouver, I was in 03 for the Typography Conference. And it's great to be back here talking about a subject that average people find just as interesting, web accessibility. I will now engage in the ritual of photographing my audience. If you want to photograph me, this is the time to do it. I will now pretend to be photographing you while you're photographing me. We're all about artifice here in Vancouver. Yes, all right. Fireside chat. Yesterday we discovered that there was actually a pristine example of an echt modernist white leather divan behind the curtains. So we decided to use it for a fireside chat. Of course, the problem is, everything I'm wearing except my shoes matches the divan and the side table and the MacBook and my script. So I will now disappear as though I were in a chroma keyed background on a CGI film. Okay, announcements first. Tonight we are having a boys' night out. En français, sortie nocturne pour les gars. I've spent 25 years of my life working for other people. I proudly say to all my friends that I work for disabled people, right? I have a vast portfolio of articles and other activities working for the equality of different groups, right? Do I have to do that when I'm trying to go out and get wasted on cranberry juice? No, I don't. So tonight at 10 o'clock in the lobby of this hotel, come down, boys only, no girls, no trannies, sorry kids. And we are going to go out to Pump Jack and take it from there. This event will be of interest to the LGBTQI2S star communities, as not only people with disabilities are the groups I've been supporting over the years, but also our diverse LGBTQI2S star communities. The WCAG Samurai, Les Samurai de WCAG. Many of you will recall that when I wrote an article for Zeldman called To Hell with WCAG 2, I announced the formation of the WCAG Samurai, a top secret group who would do nothing but write errata for WCAG 1.0. Right? If you've been checking that site, and if the Wi-Fi is working in here, you can look at wcagsamurai.org right now. You'll find that I have many notations that work has been going slowly. That is a euphemism. We have done no work whatsoever. The leader has not done work, but the leader is a procrastinator. This will come to an end, though. I'm announcing here that WCAG Samurai Errata for WCAG 1.0 will be ready for my next personal appearance on the web standards circuit at the At Media Conference in San Francisco in May. That gives us a deadline, right? The open and closed project and micropatronage. As many of you know, I am trying to start a research project that is not related to web accessibility, except in as much as there is a video on the web. It is to produce a set of standards on how to do captioning, audio description, subtitling, and dubbing, work on improved screen fonts for captioning and subtitling, and work on a universal file format for interchange of captioning, subtitling, description, and dubbing files. I've been sitting on this for 4 years, and it was time to do something about it. So I appealed to what I believe to be my friends in the development community and asked for micropatronage last November. I'm honored to report that almost 190 donors have donated about two-thirds of my nominal goal of $7,777. It's about $5,600. That has been keeping me afloat during this time. I have been doing things, unfortunately not enough, but some. I have filed documents with the Federal Broadcast Regulator, the CRTC. I have had meetings with funders. I've met my first scientific methodologist who has a PhD in statistics, and he and I are working on developing actual methodologies to test these things. So work is going slowly. When I get back to Toronto, after I do a couple of other things, I'm going to be writing the serious funding letters that my lawyer can send out. I expect that roughly one-third of my donors are in the room. I am the only Canadian who does not believe in false modesty, so I will ask, who in this room has donated to my micropatronage campaign? It's less than a third, but there are quite a few of you. You and everyone else have my continued thanks. Now it's time for a scoop. If you go, assuming the Wi-Fi works, to joeclark.org/TVL, it can be uppercase or lowercase, you'll find a document dated today, which is a call for Tim Berners-Lee to cancel WCAG 2. The entire enterprise is to be scrapped, I recommend. Yes. Which receives a scattered applause for the record. Sean Lawton Henry is in the audience, and she's just mortified. And I apologize to you, Sean. Don't take it personally. For all the reasons that were explained in my article and on many blog posts, and very concisely explained on that page, there is no future for WCAG 2. It will be met with distrust by developers, does not actually serve people with disabilities. You can't understand the thing, the WCAG working group is compromised. We don't really need it. Among other things, there are many of you in this audience, spearheaded by Andy Clark, actually, and some other researchers in the United Kingdom, are advancing the proposition that we should look at accessibility in a more holistic way. Of course you start with web standards, of course you start with guidelines, but if that still results in inaccessibility, if your user tests prove that things don't work, then do whatever it takes, even if it's tab index equals -1, the embed tag, shooting videos and posting them on YouTube, whatever it takes. You know, PowerPoint, Microsoft Word, anything, right? If the goal is accessibility, sometimes we have to extend beyond guidelines. And in any event, the guidelines problem will be solved by the WCAG Samurai Errata for WCAG 1.0. You don't have to take notes if you don't want to. As is my custom, when I get back, I'll put all my notes up on my website, joeclark.org/nord, which is a mispronunciation of the French word for north, and is also, of course, a reference to the typeface Antique Olive Nord, the ultra-bold version of this really quite unique typeface that works surprisingly well in continuous text. Those are my fingers at the bottom. And the last bit of housekeeping is that I promised myself that this would inaugurate a new era in which I cease to utter an expletive on stage, and I intend to live with that. Fuck shit. Blew it. Look at this. This is what happens when you go by your script. Can I do that all over again? We're going to go back. If you'd like to email me, my address is joeclark@joeclark.org. You can email me. I can catch my email up in the room. I promise not to utter an expletive. And I'm going to live by that. There we go. Thank you. All right. Now, to the business of the day. I want to dedicate my presentation to my old friend, Heidi Overhill, in Toronto. She's not dead or anything. She doesn't have a website either. She's I don't know if those are equivalent. she's one of the few female industrial designers in Ontario. She's written some interesting papers on chopping an onion and why things that are soft are never industrial design, but things that are hard always are. She's the one who introduced me to design process. She taught that course on that subject for a long time, actually. And quite by accident, we have two sessions at this conference about design process. That was, I assure you, just a curious coincidence of the gods, sort of like Helvetica and universe being designed in the same era. We'll see how many of my ideas Dave and Verla steal tomorrow. All right, design process. You can look at it as a 4 or 5 stage method, right? I'm going with the 5-stage definition: observation, ideation, evaluation, refinement, and presentation. Now, we're going to do a real-world case study, and the good part is we get to go to Safari to do this. Yes. All those were in Acrobat, by the way. I'm the only person on the web standards circuit who uses Acrobat for slides. Right, what we're going to be talking about today is the TTC, the Toronto Transit Commission. This is the public transit organization in Toronto. They run a 69-station subway network and a massive range of buses and streetcars. It's a sort of 1950s organization, very male-dominated, which has, curiously enough, a large online fan base. These are sort of oil and water. The two communities don't really talk to each other, though that changed last Sunday. The issue is, like, my little maxim is, they run it, but we love it, right? We have these ideas like the 69 Station Club. These are some photos by Dave Topping, a young guy in Toronto who went to all 69 stations of the TTC in 69 days. Other variations of the 69 Station Club are going to every station, getting a transfer to prove you're there, and putting that up on your blog. Here's another photo montage of the interesting typography on the subway station walls. If you go to my website, joeclark.org/TTC, you can find out more about that. The Spacing magazine, an interesting magazine that I generally support, has put out a wildly popular range of $1 subway buttons in the typography of the different stations. They sold 60,000 of them. Curiously enough, the TTC's official merchandise sales were only 50,000 in the last year the figures were available, so they must be doing something right. We've had art exhibits about the TTC. The online fan base took all their Flickr photos and actually printed them out, put them up on the walls of a gallery. At this so-called in-transit exhibit, they had a leaderboard you could walk up to and tick off which subway station you used. My station, Greenwood, is not on this slide. Then last Sunday, we had this curious event called the Toronto Transit Camp, modeled after the bar camp, demo camp, sort of gatherings, right, where everyone got together and talked about a million different things about the TTC. I gave another of my presentations on TTC signage, the second one that week. And these two chicks not only redesigned the subway car, they built a diorama for their subway car and produced a slideshow on their computer to present about this diorama that they had produced. Things are looking up with the online fan base in the TTC, because it has a new chair, Adam Jambroni, a city councillor in Toronto, who is 29 years old and uses a Mac. He is the new chair of the Toronto Transit Commission. Right? Now, today we're going to talk about the TTC and its website as a case study in applying the design process to accessibility and vice versa. All right, so let me talk to you about the community development of the TTC website. About a month and a half ago, 4 of the city blogs in Toronto met Adam Jambroni and complained that the TTC website was total crapola and needed to be fixed. On these 4 city blogs, they canvassed for public comments on what they wanted to see, right, in a new and revised TTC website. Everyone was coming up with features, things they wanted the website to do, right? I wrote in saying we need web standards and accessibility before we started talking about features. And I also said we shouldn't be doing this much free work for a $1 billion corporation. Now, even though everything is online and the TTC could fire up their IE6 on their Windows NT workstations, almost all of them except Jambroni's are exactly that, and go and look at the comments themselves, the blog editors later put them all together in one spot. which they presented in an Excel spreadsheet using acronyms. So city blog comments on how to improve the website were presented to the TTC, allegedly in the only format they could understand, a proprietary document file replete with acronyms. Right? So let's go through those phases one after another. Observation. Now, since this is done in S5, I should be able to boost the size until we start. Ooh, there we go. Isn't that kooky? Yeah. In the first step, of course, we observe the problem, right? Now, this is where we also use Safari, and with any luck, the net connection will work. Well, we seem to be going to Apple, so I guess it is working. Hold on here. So if any of you can get the net to work on your computers right now, you can go to ttc.ca, right, which should work by itself, but it then will redirect to a set of pages inside the City of Toronto website. If you have your speakers on, you might find an interesting tweet too. And then we wait. How about that local sports team? Are we done yet? There we go. All right, let's see. Now, I'm going to go through my list so I don't have another incident like the one with the previous slides. What's wrong with this site? It was thrown together in 1998 by an animation student, actual fact. And has not been touched since, actual fact. Uses tables for layout, 7. Plays a subway chime when you load the page if you're using IE6 on Windows. Has a crawling marquee at the top, which today says, old tokens no longer accepted. Token exchange locations closed February 28th, 2007. Uses drop-down lists for navigation, which I won't touch because they might auto-activate. Lists transit routes by number only and doesn't link one direction of a route with the other direction. You can find out how to get there but can't find out how to get back. It has hidden features like TTC commission reports and multilingual information, which you can see in this animated GIF down here. French, Greek, Italian, Korean, Polish, and so on. They even have Tamil. It has no defined user, and it ignores the online fan base. It exists in a world that's sort of like Microsoft Windows. It has a lot of users, but nobody loves it. Okay, so in the ideation phase, we come up with ideas to fix what we observed. Now, a lot of these were listed on the 4City blogs, and if you thought about it for 5 minutes, you'd come up with half them yourself. Well, we start with web standards, goes without saying. We need a trip planner. Every other city worth its salt has a trip planner, right? How do you get from A to B and then back to A? Use RSS in some way. That may not have accessibility implications. Some kind of notification, like, where's my bus, right? That may use RSS, may use SMS, who knows, right? Vehicle and route schedules in different formats. You can actually find out where to go in an understandable way. And some kind of API so that outside programmers can fill in the blanks from what the official site doesn't have. That's your ideation phase, right? You can spend all afternoon doodling in your notebook about that, or you can just jot things down quickly. In the evaluation phase, this is where accessibility really comes in. You spotted all those problems and you've brainstormed all the solutions, but if you're a typical designer or developer, in other words, no one in this room and no one listening to the podcast, you will just forge right ahead and ignore accessibility, right? If you come up with a feature that you can't think of how to make accessible, or if it doesn't even occur to you, you'll just go right ahead. Accessibility is never a deal breaker. Accessibility is never a reason to cancel a feature or delay its implementation, right? Well, that's the old way of thinking, and I'm going to show you how it's possible to include accessibility in all stages. The interesting thing is you have to remove yourself from the confines of the web world and begin to understand accessibility in real world terms too. All right, let's go through these things one at a time. Web standards, well, what does that mean? How far back do you want to go in compatibility? I read a report the other week on an evaluation of e-commerce accessibility at bank sites in Finland. Someone was trying to remediate one of the so-called accessible pages at one of the banks. He refused to use the label element on forms because it wasn't supported in Opera 6. Is that how far back we're going to go? Trip planner, that always seems to rely on Google Maps. Well, what if Google goes out of business between now and 2015? The existing site wasn't touched for 8 years. Maybe the revised site, if there is one, won't be touched for 8 years. If you think that a company like Google can't go out of business, where is Borland today? What happened to Lotus? Anything can happen, right? In any event, if you have a trip planner with maps, that assumes you can see and use the mouse, right? How is it going to handle vague inputs, like landmarks that the programmers down in California have never heard of, right? If I want to get from the Starbucks in the beach to the Loblaws on DuPont, can I get there? Well, we can check, because we can go to maps.google.ca, and again, wait for it to load, and put that in, and see what happens. Because this will be the sort of data that would almost inevitably be used in a case like this. Okay, so Starbucks in the beach, Toronto. Let's just search and see what happens. Again, how about that local sports team? First of all, you have to wait for the first map to load. Yes, then it has to go and have to find what I'm looking for. By the way, your bus is coming down the street while you're waiting for this, right? You're going to miss your bus. Like, on the weekends, my bus runs every 20 minutes, right? I'm going to miss my bus and have to wait in the freezing cold for 20 minutes. Yeah. When it decides to get its acting gear, we'll come back to that, right? Now, RSS, that's a really hot idea for elite web developers, like everyone in this room, but how is that going to work for real users who are standing at their bus or streetcar stop or in the subway where the internet does not work? What exactly does that mean? Schedules, okay, but for which devices? You want schedules on your iPod? All right. Would you like schedules in a format that you can use on an accessible device? Well, I'll show you a picture of those in a minute. Okay, so this is all we've got. We've got a map slowly coming in. That is about 15 miles diagonally from where I want to be. I'm actually down here at the lower right where the cursor is there. That's where I really want to be. And it's showing me things that are all the way up here. The first landmark is up there. So much for Google. All right. So let's go back. You can make schedules for an accessible PDA, like the Braille Note. That's a real device you can buy. It has a Windows CE or equivalent operating system in there. Reads Microsoft Word and text files. It has IE6 in it. I kid you not. It has a refreshable Braille display and a computerized Braille keyboard of the sort that anyone who's ever seen a Perkins Brailler will be familiar with. Oh, the site for the Braille Note has a 3D virtual tour that uses Flash, and all its links use JavaScript. Do you want podcasts of some kind? What are you going to do with that? Doesn't make any sense. H cards or V cards or some kind of micro format, that might make sense, right? That could be useful, right? But the question is, how many of those things could a blind person use, for example? Shouldn't you be thinking of alternatives like a phone line? The TTC already had one of those. In the 80s and 90s, every single surface stop in the TTC system had its own unique phone number. Sometimes two or three in a row would share one phone number, but that was the principle. You could phone it and the recorded voice would tell you what the scheduled arrival of the next vehicle or vehicles were. This is believed to be the only casualty of Y2K. It was claimed to be Y2K non-compliant, so it was decommissioned at the end of 1999. But you could bring that back now. The Toronto area has four area codes. It is now possible to use thousands of telephone numbers to put one of them on every bus and streetcar stop in the city. And that could be very convenient for a blind person, especially someone who, say, elderly and has sort of an age-related vision loss and doesn't really consider himself or herself visually impaired. Isn't that better than those other technological solutions? Text messaging. Well, it's great. Maybe you want to be standing at the bus stop and get dinged 15 cents per message from the bus telling you that it's three stops away, then two stops away, then one stop away right over there, then right in front of you. Does that really work? And also, text messaging is not that widespread in Canada, right? Because we have competing cell phone formats here, right? There's only one major provider that uses GSM, for example, right? So text messaging is not widespread. Now, at this point, I'm going to cheat and put Wheeltrans into this category, and I'm only introducing it deliberately here as a bit of a cheat. Wheel-Trans is a separate paratransit service for people with disabilities that prevent them from using, in quotation marks, the existing system, right? Some subway stations have elevators, some buses are accessible, none of the streetcars are. But if you have some other disability that prevents you from using the regular system, if you meet strict eligibility criteria, you can sign up for Wheel-Trans, which requires you to phone a telephone number 4 days in advance to book your trip. They might come up to an hour before or after your desired start or arrival time. They might be able to get you only one direction. They can get you to the movie or to the doctor, but not back home. And they just turn down flat tens of thousands of trips every year. You pay full fare, which is only equitable, but the paratransit service is so expensive that there's a subsidy of about $30 per ride. Well, why should these people with disabilities be stuck using a creaky phone line, getting busy signals all day trying to book a ride for what is already a substandard service? Shouldn't that be done online? But if you're going to do that, are you going to make the Wheel-Trans portions of the TDC site more accessible than the rest of it? Because, of course, we know they're disabled, so they deserve maximum accessibility. Or are you going to make the entire site equally accessible? What if you book a ride on Wheel-Trans, but you can actually get there on the accessible bus or subway system? Is your beautifully web standards compliant and accessible site going to be smart enough to tell you that? Multilingualism. You know your site has to be multilingual because Toronto is a multicultural city. In WCAG, you have to indicate a change of language, which implies that you have to indicate the source language, like HTML language equals EN-CA. I'm a staunch defender of Canadian English, so I had to put that up there. But how are you going to handle right-to-left languages? There are several of those in wide use in Toronto, in order, Urdu, Farsi, and Arabic. What about sign language? If you add sign language, what are you really adding? Developers, well, developers want an API. Well, how does that help real users in the real world, right? Especially users with disabilities. You're going to have to take all these questions and come up with some kind of prototype to improve this TTC site. Now, even though a single developer could not possibly bid on a redevelopment of a giant website like that, I'm not going to give away the store and tell you what my ideas are for a prototype, right? But we can move right along, go to the refinement stage. I think I'm too big here, hold on. Oh dear. Don't you hate when S5 crashes on you? Yeah, hold on. All right. S5 has crashed on me. Someone call Eric Meyer. All right, refinement stage. This is where user testing comes in. Now, which groups are you going to test with, right? For some of their signage projects, TDC tested with riders with no special characteristics, visually impaired riders, riders with low literacy who are mostly children, and ESL, English as a second language groups, right? For another feature, platform edge marking so that blind people wouldn't walk straight off the platform into the path of an oncoming train, which happened once with fatal results. They tested a number of surfaces. The one we have at present is yellow rubber with little truncated domes on it. They initially tried a true dome, but found that that was too wobbly and people were feeling unsafe and unbalanced on it. So they took the dome and sliced the top off it. They tested that with wheelchair users and women in high heels, among other groups. There is already a precedent for testing with user groups, but which ones are you going to test with? It's time consuming but easy for a developer to test on numerous platforms. You can just buy crap old computers from garage sales and install Linux and OS 9 on them and test on those things. Recent versions of Windows and Mac OS are readily available. You can test on numerous browsers. You can even do keyboard testing yourself because typing with one finger is a very close analog to what many people with mobility impairments do. But for testing beyond that, you need human subjects. And don't you need a special budget for that? Show of hands, how many people have, on the first go, submitted a proposal for a web development that included a discrete line item budget for user testing and had it approved on the first go? Six out of a room of several hundred. So where are you going to find the money for this user testing? And your typical web testing uses the think aloud protocol, where the subject sits there in this weird interrogation suite with cameras and one-way mirrors around them, right? It's the Abu Ghraib of web standards, right? Yeah, and they're expected to just sit there and speak out loud what they're thinking, what they're doing, what they're looking at. This is unnatural in the first place, and especially if you're trying to look, test how long it takes to complete a task, that's probably an unnatural way of doing it. But if you're testing, you know, the only group that people seem to think is important to test with beyond non-disabled people, that is blind people using screen readers, isn't the voice output from the screen reader going to interfere with the think-aloud protocol? Right? I've done this kind of user testing, right? Sometimes if you have a super elite user, they know how to temporarily pause and restart the speech on JAWS. It's just touching the control key. And I had a really good user who could just duck in and restore her own speech and just tell me exactly what she was doing and then start it up again. I had another user who just talked over everything and sort of with the cocktail party effect, I could understand what he was saying. But if that's really a problem, why don't you just use headphones, right? Why doesn't the screen reader user just use headphones? If you want to use the talk aloud protocol, what if you're testing with a person with cerebral palsy who can't really talk? All right, so now you've got a trip planner. You know that's one of the features you want. And you know that blind and mobility impaired people can't use it. So what can you do? Well, you can refine your proposal and give route directions in prose. You can write out in words how to get from A to B and back again. That lends itself to web standards markup. That's obviously an ordered list, isn't it? You can show a static picture of a map using various testing or detection methods, I should say. You could tell when someone doesn't need or want a movable map, you can just show a picture. Or you can just show a schematic with really big lines and arrows of which streets to go on so that a low vision person could get right up on the screen and sort of follow along like that. If you really had to, you could hack your own keyboard controls using the Google Maps API, for example, to nudge the map up and down and zoom it in. TTC has its own in-house cartographer, at least one that I know of. So if you're worried about Google going under, well, you can just have that person, you know, gain a new staff and produce their own in-house maps. Web standards, well, you know you have to make it work, you know, decently without CSS. That should be no problem, really, right? Essentially, the site already works without CSS. There really isn't any. but then the question is, how do you make it work without JavaScript? Well, really, the only serious JavaScript implementation you'll have is the map. And you've already come up with ways to refine your map proposal so it would work without a movable map. In that case, you wouldn't even need JavaScript in that case. Schedules, well, schedules are a nightmare. Why don't we go take a look? Let's see, now, schedules, now if I wanted to find the schedule for my bus, where the hell is it? I really don't know, I'm not making this up. Schedules, okay, so you go there and then it auto-directs you and you wait. Okay, this is the existing system, right? This is a frame set, by the way. Okay, so now I have to know what my route is. In this case, I do. Fortunately, it's a low number. It's 31. As you can see, they just have them by number, and they go all the way to 512. And most of them are doubled because they go east, west, north, south. They have they're paired, right? Okay, so I want 31 north. If I want to get to the subway station. Fortunately, they have a go button. Okay, so we go there. Now I have to, or it gives me a map, which is, you know, fine. Now I have to pick which location I want. I want Greenwood at Queen, Far Side, which is two words, not one. This is also a frame set, so it reloads this. So this now is the bus schedule. Hold on, I will scroll this and make this center that in your field of view there on the screen. Okay, so if you can read that, you're doing better than I can. Like the first column just says AM, B534, B44, B604, B19, B34. There's another column of AMs, a third column of AMs, which is broken up by the notation PM. The Bs eventually end, or do they? I don't know. Saturday seems to only be Bs. Right, Sunday sees only BBs. Well, you wouldn't know it, but this is actually the unusual branch that goes down by the post office in the middle of nowhere. Right, it's a good place to be, you know, assaulted. Right, it's literally in the middle of nowhere. Because of the TDC lacks real world knowledge of its own routes, you actually get the bus at the southward pointing terminus. It turns all the way around. It goes all the way back north up to the subway station. But the schedule doesn't tell you that. As far as this is concerned, it only runs every, 10 minutes, very early in the morning and late at night, ending at 1 a.m., and it doesn't tell you how to get back, right? So imagine how you could mark this up. First of all, tables, this goes without saying. You could write them out in prose, you can make files compatible with iPods and Braille notes. You can make printable versions that are nice and big that you can stick on your fridge door, right? So you're sitting there, and if you have a choice of buses to take, you can look and tell which one is coming. You can make small ones you can fold up in your pocket. A guy in Toronto, Sean Lerner, has made his own TTC subway efficiency guide with little schematic diagrams where to stand in the subway car so that when you walk off, the exit door is right there. That sort of thing can be done, right? It's quite a labor of love, and he, hand cut them, hand stapled them, and everything, right? Oh, and he got threatening letters from the TTC when he did that. If you make these printable versions, you have to make large printable versions, right? This is another case where accessibility extends into the real world. You have to make really big ones, including large print foldable pocket-sized schedules, which actually can be done if you imagine folding things in thirds and halves. Language, everything on the entire site, from the TTC logo to the nav bars to the search, has to work right to left and left to right. And you have to be careful with the colors red and green for cultural reasons that you may be aware of. For people with learning disabilities, this is actually a case where we might be able to do something for a change. A site like a public transit systems actually lends itself to plain language. You can explain things in plain language, sort of like listing routes in prose instead of just showing a map. There could be a simple version. As soon as you go into the site, it could give you an option for a simple version where it could walk you through, step by step, the most common tasks that people have at a public transit website. Testing. Well, when you're testing, you will find that you forgot to deal with customer feedback. Obviously, people will want to have a form that they can use to write customer feedback. Maybe they'll even want to be able to upload things like photographs of a dirty subway car or a bad sign. That came up at transit camp, actually. So that's fine. You can do that, right? How are you going to keep the TTC from being spammed? As we know, it's quite possible to use forms to produce spam. That's why we have splogs, right? That's why we have these inaccessible CAPTCHAs, right? How are you going to deal with that problem, right? Especially in a way that a person with a learning disability could actually use. But getting back to the real world, shouldn't you just make it really easy to find the voice telephone and TTY phone numbers? Does everything on a website have to be executed through the internet? And your testing will probably show that people will confuse the accessibility of the site with accessibility of the system. Are you going to address that? And if after all that testing you find that some things are still not accessible for certain people, even though you've done everything correctly according to web standards and WCAG, right, then it's time to break the rules. Put up PowerPoints. Produce videos with open captioning, put them on YouTube, do whatever is necessary until you can actually provide accessibility for people with disabilities. Those things would tend to be additional things. The things you'd use PowerPoints and videos for would also exist in other nice, tidy, compliant forms. But if those tidy, compliant forms don't work with real people, then you have to do something else, right? And once you've done all that, you have to test it all over again, right? Because you might make a fix, and then the fix might still not work. Now, for a large organization like TTC, Another issue in the refinement phase is breaking the cycle of PDFs, right? This afternoon, I missed my first PDF universal accessibility phone call because I was here with you people. Don't worry, you're worth it. We need to wean the TTC off their use of PDFs and the use of Microsoft Word to export HTML, right? So the first thing you do is install the plugin plugin for Word for Windows that outputs tagged PDFs automatically, right? So there are two big advantages to that, one of which you may know and the other you may not know. Let's start with the one that you do know about. By adding tags to a PDF, tags are simply XML, you have produced a tree structure for the document. A tree structure is the same in most cases as a reading order. A reading order is important for screen reader users and also for not very atypical cases, like you want bigger fonts and all of a sudden the PDF would want to scroll off the right-hand side of the screen. You can simply reflow the text in compatible applications like Acrobat, so it gives you your own automatic zoom layout. It takes your two or three column text and moves it into a single column text. You need a defined reading order for that. That's something tags do. But at a more mundane level, untagged PDFs often do not contain any space characters. PDF does not require the inclusion of the space character or anything that's like a space character. PDF is based on PostScript. They just write the word out with the pen, lift the pen, move it over a little, and write the next word. And that gap, that absence of writing, is interpreted by a sighted or a non-disabled person as a space. But an untagged PDF does not necessarily include those literal space characters. So if you present an untagged PDF to someone with a crap screen reader or even a good screen reader, they won't necessarily be able to read it because under some conditions, all the words will run together because the only characters in the file are the visible characters. Most tagging applications will explicitly put in space characters. Something as mundane as that can undo your attempts at PDF accessibility. So even if you use non-semantic tags, even if your PDF has everything as a paragraph, every single thing as a paragraph, you'll probably still get the advantages of reading order and correct Unicode representation. And in any event, you may have to move people away from using Microsoft Word as a final bit of software before publication. The US Senate wrote its own software for the production of legislation, which is all done under XML. Even though the visual typographic appearance in the printed documents looks almost exactly the same as it has for decades, they have their own built-in XML editors that are sort of like WordPerfect for DOS. They have these sort of hidden codes that you cannot delete if it would cause invalidity, right, or ill-formedness, right? And after a lot of user testing, they developed a way to inform people when they were trying to, say, you know, delete a root node of a paragraph, which they didn't actually want to do, right? If the US Senate can do that, why can't a multi-billion dollar organization? You can set up Microsoft Word to produce less horrific HTML. It can be done with great effort. Remember, if you're going by accessibility guidelines, you don't have to have valid code for WCAG Priority 1. And all these output documents, which can be things like commission minutes and meeting schedules and agendas and reports, those could be in a section of your site that you know is only going to meet Priority 1. It can have largely crap HTML, but it's still HTML. Or you might have to just hire someone to be on staff to do nothing but convert these documents to proper semantic forms. Canadian federal government has a lot of people doing that. So, I mean, PDF is a classic accessibility bugbear, but I think one of the bigger problems is PowerPoint, because the TDC is a prisoner of PowerPoint. They do almost everything that Eddie Tufte warns you against doing, right? The only thing they don't do is have like little animated GIFs, like with a mouse with a spinning piece of cheese that it's trying to catch or something. It's the only thing they don't do. Every other thing you're supposed to avoid doing, they do, right? No one has come up with a really good accessibility solution for PowerPoint. If you Google around and try to find the converters, like from University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, they don't really do that good a job. You have to sit there writing alt texts for everything post facto. There's really no such thing as document order. Even simple things like, you know, bulleted lists. The bullet may not actually exist as a logical entity. It might simply be displayed. That has never been addressed, right? And in the last phase of the design process presentation, you got the whole thing done, you've tested the hell out of it. As far as you know, it works, right? You've uploaded it to the test server, made sure that all the character encodings work, because we know things like that can happen on bad days. As far as you know, it's good to go. This is not a time to be modest. You need to get the word out that your new and better and accessible site is online. And for something like a transit system, that means you have to produce a printed brochure to notify people of your new improved website, because you're riding the bus and you may have a crackberry with the always on net connection, or you may not. You're in the subway and there's no connection whatsoever. You have no way of telling that there is a website from while you're riding the system itself. But if you take this physical artifact off the peg and read about it and see the pictures and learn all about it, you can keep that and bring it home or bring it to the office. And the next time you're online, you can check it. But if you're going to make a printed brochure to be put on the vehicles, how do you deal with things like large print, braille, audio tape? You can't necessarily have those hanging off the same hooks on the bus. That defeats the purpose. The accessible versions defeat and undermine the purpose of having this thing that people notice without even, you know, attempting to notice it, so they learn about it. You would have to go and try to find this large print version, or the braille version, or the audio tape version. I don't have a solution on how to do that. Post videos. All the kids love the YouTube, right? Put things on YouTube with open captioning. You know, pimp your site. This is where you use podcasts, and you must have transcription, but it can be post facto. This is where you start having podcasts about how you develop the site, user testing. You can do interviews with the users, including users with disabilities, right? You can have your own subway party. There's a group in Toronto called New Mind Space, and they have a website, newmindspace, all one word, .com. And they do subway parties at irregular intervals. They just agree to meet at one of the termini of the subway system, go into the last car, and you know, have their own drummers. According to the guy who made a presentation at Transit Camp, they now have an emissions-free generator that produces 1,000 watts. So they have their own sound system and DJ in a subway car, right? Throw your own party to launch your own website. Why the hell not? And then since much of this process started with these four city blogs, taking ideas to the new 29-year-old Mac-using chair of the TTC and then putting out public comment and then sending all those ideas back to the TTC, well, re-co-opt those same bloggers, right? That's how you can, take an example like this, a large public transit system, and apply the design process to accessibility. Now, when I did my first run-through, that was 53 minutes. How long have I spent? Now I get up and check my stopwatch. Hold on. I want to see if I'm under time. 44. Okay, we have tons of time for questions. We have tons of time for questions, and he's our mic man. Now I'm really going to sit down and relax. Don't all put your hands up at once. Jeez. Look, I can't bomb on the questions. Think of something. Ask me what my pet cat's name was growing up.
How do you see something like the open document format as an accessible alternative to Microsoft Word or PowerPoint or PDFs?
Well, it would, to my knowledge, and I have deliberately ceased to follow that topic because there's only so much I can do in the run of a day. Its only advantage is that it's a published specification, right? I'm big on published specifications. They don't have to be open in any defined sense. They just have to be available, right? So open document would be fine, sure. RTF and Word wouldn't, right? PDF might. HTML almost certainly is, right? So it's the openness of the specification that enables adaptive technology and browsers and your phone and all these other devices to actually use it in an accessible way. Next. Over there, yes. And stand up this time because I'm seated, right? And I can't really see you.
Hi, my name is Brian. This discussion about transit systems is fascinating. I've lived in a couple big cities, and I've never seen it done even close to right. Do you have any examples that we could go look at where somebody has actually addressed maybe a quarter or a third of
transit for London? Transit for London isn't bad. The MTA in New York is crap. Looks just like the the TDC site, actually. Thank you. I was just going to Google that. The one in LA tries really hard. It has an interesting little route planner, right? Because they have this new subway that no one takes, right? So they have an interesting route planner. But Transport for London is kind of busy, kind of a busy site. But I think their hearts are in the right places, and I've used it in Lynx quasi satisfactorily, right? Quasi. It's true, no one has really done this right because it's an immense problem. It takes six digits of money to fix, right? Now, and a typical transit system is run by 50-year-old guys, right? And jumped up motormen who don't really understand this computer stuff, right? They top post all their emails, they use Microsoft Outlook, right? These are all indicators of cluefulness, right? But in Toronto now, we have a guy who's under 30, uses one of these. So, and that's what's going to improve, we hope. Next, lady here. Actually, you had your hand up. You'll be next, Andy.
Thanks. Yeah, it's an interesting talk you've done. It's interesting because you have a real-world example of a designed system, and then you have the web analog, right? And how you're saying that people can say, well, the system's accessible, but your website isn't.
The system's partially accessible.
Right.
But the website is, in broad terms, completely inaccessible.
And so that just leads me to a question that you might want to, riff on. I've experienced that, I've had the experience of going into organizations that weren't clear about what they were trying to do, like, say, an urban environmental organization, and I'm the web designer, I'm trying to find a vocabulary that I can use for site navigation that will make their purpose clear to the public, but what I have to do as a first step is sit them down and make them clear about themselves. And so I realize that as a so-called web designer, I actually become a counselor of a sort to organizations on how to define themselves, and so that's an interesting niche, perhaps, market niche.
Yes, and I'm sometimes good. I'm hit or miss on that personally. I mean, I can teach blind kids to forget what they learned in the previous 4 days of a summer computer camp, teach them real HTML in one day. I can do that. But sometimes with the middle-aged people, you try to explain to them, well, the idea of web standards is you write your website correctly so it works in different browsers, and you can tell they're blanking on the concept of browser because they don't know there's such a thing as a browser because they just double-click on the E, right? They don't know there's such a thing as a browser. These are in the same continuum of people who use Google to go to websites. They type Earls into Google, right? And the same continuum of people who type Google into Google, right? Right? They're along the same continuum. Now, look, I'm a pretty sarcastic person, sometimes impatient, and I look down on that sort of thing, of course. The first instinct is to think, how can you be so clueless, right? But the issue is, almost everyone in this room is really good at computers. Not everyone is, but now almost everyone uses the web. And there are going to be people who don't know what a browser is, right? So then you show them things like Firefox, you show them tabs. Then they have this standard of comparison. They know that, you know, that the fish has been taken out of water, and they finally see it. So the trick is to get over this first impulse to ridicule them for being so clueless. These things, you know, ignorance is curable, right? So I don't have a lot of success dealing with like the 50-year-old types who don't know there's a browser, right? Room full of blind kids, maybe. So I don't know. It may require counter programming, right? I mean, that should be a female-run project. Maybe it should be three women to come in and teach all the guys, right? Because that sort of disarms them. I don't know. Maybe it should be other 50-year-old guys with iron rings in their fingers, meaning they're professional engineers. I don't know. I don't have a solution to that. But you've identified a real problem. Andy Clark, right here, stage. You know.
I couldn't agree with you more on the cancellation of WCAG 2. And I think that there's a whole load of people that are actually actively out there testing and developing solutions for accessibility that are going to agree as well. So this is a kind of a two-part question. How can we help you to promote that cause? And secondly, the second part of the question is, away from the front line in terms of developers, I'm talking specifically about governments at different levels, away from the frontline developers who we would kind of hope know what accessibility is and what it means in real practice, I have to say that most of the people that I've ever come into contact in any form of government are clueless about accessibility to the level that they think that WCAG and other legislation has come from God in the same way that as the Bible and the Quran. How can we educate those people that it's about real life education and about real life implementations and not about guidelines that are set from on high?
Yeah, and the classic example, of course, is you must always have default text in your search field because WCAG says so, although they always miss those very, very pesky initial words until user agents no longer require that, right? Yeah, a strict and literal interpretation of WCAG, which is what a lot of government employees would look at, would lead to an outdated, possibly inaccessible site, right? So at that point, you have to be a really smart developer and say, well, we are complying with WCAG. It says until user agents no longer require default text. Well, they no longer do, and here's proof, and hand them a printout of what existing browsers and adaptive technologies can do. And then you explain them, well, we are intelligently applying WCAG, which is now 9 years old or 8 years old, right? That's the sort of thing you have to do and hope they go for it, right? You have a bit of an out on that because if they require WCAG priority 2, then in theory that requires valid code all the time, which is impossible to maintain on a large site 24 hours a day. But you know, the day you demo it, it can have valid code and you can run it through that. You just tick through some of the less controversial items. Or you can just be terribly clever and say, yes, we've met everything in WCAG. In fact, we've exceeded it. And what the examples you show that illustrate how you've exceeded WCAG are those ways that we've learned to actually reinterpret the guidelines 8 years later, like not putting search terms in. So you make yourself seem like you're, you know, very au courant developers, right? If you're personable and are a good salesperson, that last one is the first thing you should do because you can make that fly, right? On your first question about how you can help, the way you can help is just keep doing what you're doing, right? here's a little quest. Can one of you on one of your personal blogs do a search, or like a really good targeted search, of w3.org excluding the mailing lists, so not lists.w3.org, and find out how many times the phrase web standards has been mentioned on w3.org, right? The situation of us and the W3C is like the Toronto online transit fans and the TTC, right? They run it, but we love it, right? So we've been doing their work for them, unbeknownst to them and behind their backs, since 2000, right? So what we have to do is just keep on keeping on. We are making these sites that are standards compliant in various ways, right? With interesting new interpretations on them. They might be using CSS3, who knows? We test them, right? We test them with actual users with disabilities. We test them with our own adaptive technologies, right? Keep on making sites that we know work, right? And do not necessarily have recourse to ticking off boxes on the WCAG. Question from Aaron, and then one at the back, I guess.
I just had a quick question. You talked about kind of being a good salesman and being able to sell yourself as an accessibility expert or stuff like that. But one thing I find a lot in the pitch process sometimes with companies is that they may have gotten a pitch from another company that may say that they're building accessible sites when they're not really building accessible sites and they're, you know, kind of selling themselves falsely. What is a good tack to take in order to show that, you know, you are actually meeting the needs? Or companies may have been burned in the past. A lot of organizations have had that happen where they've been told it's accessible, but then they find out 6 months later that it's not really, and they're...
It turned out to have 9 nested tables, yes.
Exactly.
Or 10, crashed Netscape 2. Yeah, or Netscape 4. Yes, you're right. Well, you have to hope there's a technically savvy person on staff who may not be the person who puts the tender through and signs your checks, right? 6 weeks after you submit the invoice, right? Or 6 months even, right? With any luck, you have a technically savvy person. And you try to explain to that person and have that person be a cultural interpreter for the rest of the office, right? Explain only to the technically savvy person. We're not using tables, we've done this, we're using image replacement, we're using semantics, X, Y, Z, right? That's what I would do. If you're only dealing with managers who don't really understand the web, then the only thing I can think of is try to educate them about how the real web works. Show them multiple browsers, you know, do easy things like use fangs or VoiceOver on Macintosh, even if you don't really know how to use it. Just having a computer talk what's on the screen is extremely impressive to some people, right? Try to educate them a little bit and then just give the same kind of presentation I suggested and hope it works. Now, I'm not necessarily a good model to follow on this because I'm crap at doing that, right? But I admit that. There are better salespeople. That's why I said get the most persuasive and charismatic and credible person you can who has work that they can back up, right? Another thing you can do, and this is expensive, you could have outside peer review. You could have quality assurance by a third party, right? You could have a beta site and then hand this any number of outside people some user IDs and passwords and have them try to break it and submit a report and pay them a day's rate or something like this. You could just eat the cost. You could build that in. That's another, you know, quality assurance method. I believe at the far back, right back there, you know, I'm still burned about screwing up that slide. You know, like I remember the things that go wrong for years, right? I remember things that went wrong at Web Essentials in Sydney. I remember everything that goes wrong in presentations. I hate that. Anyway, okay, hit it.
You mentioned sign language. I was wondering. You mentioned sign language. I'm having trouble thinking of any examples where that might be necessary rather than just using text.
How to use the TTC video in sign language, right? But if you're producing a video in sign language, all of a sudden you're using embed or object or something, it doesn't validate, so that busts you on WCAG 2, right? Then of course you have to make the decision, well, are you going to have a voiceover or are you not going to have a voiceover? If you have a voiceover, then you have to have captioning, so that's another stage, right? Yeah. So how to, it's a how to video. I mean, the TTC already has these crap brochures in multiple languages with really poor multilingual typography. Explaining how to use the TTC, how to take the bus, how to read the route sign, how to do X, Y, and Z. It'd be that sort of thing. Now, the BBC study from like 2002, they did user testing with various disabled groups, including deaf people, and in that group, comprising also Big D deaf people, they found they wanted plainer language and they would prefer videos in that case, British Sign Language, to explain the site. And I don't see anything wrong with that. I think that's not bad. Of course, you'd have to have a budget for it. By the way, I forgot the business about iPods. There are hearing impaired people who use iPods. A friend of mine has two hearing aids, right, which are top of the line models, right? And he has a wireless transmitter that he plugs into his iPod, which beams the music from his pocket into his hearing aids, right? Yeah. That's pretty hot. So a schedule on an iPod is not completely stupid for the entire group of people with disabilities. Next. Oh, what? My sound man has a question.
My name's Philip Chua. One of the, you know, kind of interesting challenges is we've had working with accessibility in terms of, for example, we've been working with a number of departments of justice, public legal education, in order to make their sites accessible. And we can build them to standards that we feel are consistent with accessibility, but the problem and the challenge becomes after we turn over the keys. And you know, there's some training that we can do to get our clients to understand some of the aspects, but when we return, and you know, I mean, this is sort of an age-old problem about turning sites over to clients, but I think that there is an added problem when it's with accessibility, because it actually becomes a very specialized skill that's hard to translate sometimes to, you know, staff that are typically not technically trained and are expected to, you know, maintain sites with WYSIWYGs nowadays that don't always have those kinds of things, you know, built into them.
Yeah. Well, you might want me to say that could produce a juicy and lucrative maintenance contract, but all of you know that maintenance after the site is done and haggling with the client day in and day out, that's a fate worse than death, right? You prefer to close up shop, right? My proposition in that case is staff training, right? Get the site delivered, then do a phase two of staff training, explaining to them that we have given you the keys, but you don't know how to drive, right? And we need to train you how to do things. I'm not convinced that everything is unattainable, right? Like writing alt texts and using Dreamweaver and so on. I'm not sure that's completely unattainable. And I believe that is our time for today. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, Joe, for a presentation that was wonderfully conceived.
Oh,
perfectly
thanks.
Executed.
Listen, no.
And but immaculately timed.
Yes, well, I'm 3 minutes over, but that's okay. I'll just remember that for the next
immaculate,
5 years.
That's close enough. Yeah. Now, I'm the only person standing in between everyone and free drinks. Very big thank you to Adobe, who are providing the reception this evening. All you have to do is pick up a couple of... bigger round of applause for Adobe, actually. Make sure you pick up some drinks tickets as you go out the door. And also make sure you're back here for 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, as there will be prizes for those who are here on time. Thank you very much. Have a great evening.